Hello and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. The goal of this podcast is to connect, learn, and inspire. In this podcast, you'll be hearing from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, and register to receive newsletters and find links to our social media accounts. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone who you'd like to hear from, or if there's a topic you'd like to hear about, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right, welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. TJ Robbins. He is an oral facial pain specialist. TJ, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, a couple of our listeners who are longtime listeners reached out and said we should get you on the podcast. So excited to talk to you a little bit. Can you just start by giving us a brief history of your training and your current practice setup?
Sure, of course. Currently, I practice South Carolina with a group oral surgery practice. So I actually do see some patients in North Carolina also. The group that I work with now is called Carolina Center of Oral and Facial Surgery. They've got several offices in North and South Carolina. I had a connection through a colleague to the group. And so that's how I ended up coming out here and really enjoy the Carolinas. I went to dental school at the University of Pittsburgh. And then while I was a dental student, I started getting a lot of jaw pain and neck issues not too far into my training. So made me really question, you know, if I'd made the right choice going into dentistry with neck issues and then my jaw really bothering me. So that was really a pivotal point for me where I got interested in temporomandibular disorders and facial pain in various aspects and made me start noticing, you know, there are a lot of these patients around that need guidance and help. Continued through dental school, you know, got things under control. Then I decided to do a residency in oral facial pain. Right out of dental school, I went to UCLA and did a 2-year full-time residency focusing in on temporomandibular disorders, facial pain, and headaches. And after that point, I was able to get board certified. And now I practice full scope of oral facial pain. I would say about 50, 60% of my practice is dealing with non-surgical temporomandibular disorders or working with the surgeons and trying to make sure, hey, we can have the best outcome possible and then helping post-surgery. The other 50% is all kinds of things from trigeminal neuralgia, burning mouth, various types of facial pains, and even a lot of headache conditions. So I do manage a lot of patients with migraine disorders or cluster headaches, other rare headaches that sometimes can be confused with either TMJ disorders or other types of headaches. That's where I'm at right now.
Nice. That's a great background and good training to have. So we've had a couple other, you know, oral medicine type specialists discuss various aspects, but we thought today would be good to focus on trigeminal neuralgia. You know, this is one of those things as oral surgeons, most of us don't really treat, you know, we can try to diagnose it, but I think a lot of surgeons and also just general practitioners in dentistry, you know, kind of we're not great at diagnosing it. And it's basically like when all else fails and we're not sure where the pain's coming from, let's call it trigeminal neuralgia. But maybe you can give us some more clarification. How do you diagnose trigeminal neuralgia?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think oftentimes what happens is often what you and I and other doctors, when we say trigeminal neuralgia, what we may each be picturing may be a little bit different. Kind of like if I say, hey, I'm going to buy a car. And then, you know, we all might think of, oh, somebody's going to say Mustang. Somebody's going to say Civic. Somebody might be thinking, oh, well, I'm actually a truck. You know, but those are all types of vehicles. And so trigeminal neuralgia, just like saying a TMJ disorder, really is a broad descriptive term. So oftentimes how trigeminal neuralgia is described is more of a descriptive phrase almost rather than a true diagnosis. Certainly trigeminal neuralgia is a true diagnosis, but we'll have to get into that. Just like there are various types of TMJ disorders, there's various classifications of you know, oral surgeons who are doing tons of wisdom teeth. Obviously, there's various, you know, classifications on, you know, the wisdom teeth and how they're impacted and the level, is it bony, is it routine, you know, all of those things. And so just understanding that there are different types of trigeminal nerve disorders is very important. And then we'll really talk about two or three broad classes that that fits into. So really, when we're talking about trigeminal neuralgia, we should think any disorder of the trigeminal nerve could more broadly be described as a neuropathy. I'll tell my patients, I say, hey, there are various types of neuropathies that we can experience. You know, there are patients who have peripheral neuropathy in their feet, as they're diabetic, they develop poor circulation, and they develop a neuropathy that is very painful down there. There are other neuropathies which can be of different etiologies. So that's the main thing I really want to introduce at first, is that there are different types of trigeminal neuropathies. Trigeminal neuralgia is an actual specific diagnosis, is just one type of trigeminal nerve disorder. Hopefully that makes sense for everybody. So two of the references that anybody who's really wanting to review the classification of items and really understanding what are the ins and outs of the various types of trigeminal nerve disorders, there are different reference materials. The two reference materials that, at least for me, I find most helpful, the first one is the International Classification of Headache Disorders. I just listed as ICHD-3. You look that up, it brings up a headache classification, but at the end of it, it has a really good classification on the different types of trigeminal nerve disorders. One of those is which trigeminal neuralgia. And then things really start to make more sense when we understand how do we classify these things. The other really good resource is newer. It's another classification. It's called the International Classification of Oral and Facial Pain. I think 2021 it was published. If you just look up International Classification of Oral Facial Pain, what that particular classification does really well is it includes temporal mandibular disorders. It also includes various dental alveolar issues, along with the headaches and other things. So I think for dentists, the International Classification of Oral Facial Pain is a really good resource reviewing different types of TMJ disorders, headaches that can affect the facial region, and these various types of trigeminal nerve disorders. I think one of the classic easy ways for us to understand that there's different types of quote unquote trigeminal neuralgia is, let's say there's a patient, they come in, they have these lesions on their palate, look like they've been erupted, they're all in the V2 distribution, right? Patient has a history of chicken pox, now they're 55, come in with palatal lesions, they're very painful, and they're, you know, clustered. You'd think, oh, okay, this is a herpes zoster, right? We've got a zoster's flare up here, so we get them on a steroid, maybe, you know, an antiviral medicine. Well, some of those patients can then develop a type of trigeminal neuralgia where this nerve, where this varicella zoster became active, now becomes painful after the lesions have healed. So again, that's illustrating that there's, you know, a different type of quote unquote trigeminal neuralgia. So anything after herpes zoster or shingles would be in the face would be considered, hey, this is a post-herpetic trigeminal neuralgia. Okay. That might look different than other types of trigeminal neuralgia. Okay. Now, the main trigeminal neuralgia that most of the time, more so in the broad public or medical community, not necessarily for dentists, but potentially for us too, when we think about trigeminal neuralgia, is this sharp shooting electrical or stabbing pain that happens in one, two, or potentially all three of the distributions of the trigeminal nerve. So I would say it's sharp shooting, stabbing, electrical. It's paroxysmal, meaning it's sudden. It's very short lasting, and it can be very unpredictable. One of the names, or whenever you look up trigeminal neuralgia, it says tic douloureux. So oftentimes these patients, when they have this attack of trigeminal neuralgia, it looks like they're literally having a tic or like a spasm like this because it hurts so bad. And so when a patient comes in and says, hey, I get this 10 out of 10 horrible pain in my face or feels like it's in a tooth. And then you ask them, how long does it last? Oh, it's like 10 or 15 seconds. And then you start asking them, well, what causes it? And they say, I don't know. It's random. And then you ask them, has it ever happened when we touch their face or anything like that? And a lot of times you just have to kind of weed out, you know, a few criteria that make it quite obvious that this is a true classic trigeminal neuralgia. So a sharp shooting, stabbing pain that lasts anywhere from a few seconds up to a couple minutes and can either be sudden or it can be triggered by some sort of innocuous stimulus, such as touching your face. They'll often come in, they'll have a scarf over their face, especially going in where the weather is starting to get a little warmer, fans, air conditioning, you know, even just a piece of food, anything touching their face can trigger this horrendous type of pain. So that's probably what I would consider what most people are referring to when they talk about trigeminal neuralgia, is this classic type of trigeminal neuralgia.
And it's usually unilateral, or do you see it bilaterally?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in general, I would say it's always unilateral. If there's ever anything that's bilateral like that, it would be so rare to actually truly be trigeminal neuralgia. But yeah, unilateral, sharp shooting, short-lasting, severe pain in the face. Typically, it's going to be right around here in the corner of the mouth or in this buccal vestibule. So usually V3, sometimes V2, almost never V1. So usually I'd say 70%+ of cases, in my experience, probably about 90% of cases are actually only V3. Sometimes they'll be V2 and V3. And then V1, almost never impacted. However, I will say one interesting thing that we see with trigeminal neuralgia is they always describe it or often as this shooting pain that shoots through the face. So where is it originating? Usually in the third division. And then they'll say, well, it just feels like it shoots up and goes through my eye. And that's pretty normal. And when we look at the distribution of the third mandibular division, we actually have a small area of sensation up here. This auriculotemporal nerve actually comes up. And so even, you know, when I check patients, when we're checking through V1, V2, V3 in this region. So from a nerve distribution, it certainly can radiate through the whole nerve, but it can be perceived also as shooting to other divisions.
Okay. And let's talk about like etiology. I mean, I think most of us would say we think it's like a blood vessel, something compressing the nerve in your head. But what do we know about the cause of these?
Yeah. So any sort of patient who is experiencing symptoms similar to this, or even symptoms just in this trigeminal nerve, even if it's more of an aching or throbbing or pressure down there, certainly it needs a thorough investigation. So I think what we really need to talk about is what is the workup in these patients? First things first, what's really easy for us is with our dental training is when you have somebody with suspected trigeminal nerve disorder, well, we're going to look at the teeth. We're going to take an x-ray. We're going to make sure the dental alveolar complex is fine. We're going to make sure there's no intraoral lesions. You know, is there some sort of nasty, you know, lesion on the lower mandible or potentially on the tongue that could be pushing on one of these nerves? So after we've ruled out that there's no intraoral or dental alveolar issue, then we need to start up and think, is there a TMJ issue? Sometimes TMJ issues can present with some odd symptoms. So dental alveolar rule out, make sure there's not a TMJ disorder. And then we need to move over into more of the medical workup. So as you had mentioned, certainly making sure that there's no intracranial pathology. So when you have a patient that you've ruled out these other things through your exam, really need to have an MRI taken. So this is a brain MRI. It needs to be with and without contrast. And you as the provider, if you order it, you need to then direct and help the actual radiologist to know what to look for, okay? Not all radiologists specialize in the neurologic symptoms. And there are different types of MRIs that we really need to consider ordering. So oftentimes I'll have a patient, and this has happened to me, where they've had a brain MRI and it said brain MRI was clear, had no contrast. And then I'm thinking in my head, you know, is this enough for me to feel confident that there's not a nerve and a blood vessel that are contacting each other, or that there's some sort of local pathology within the trigeminal root system or the brainstem? So the best thing that you can do is when you order that MRI, or if you see one come in, needs to say attention brainstem, rule out neurovascular conflict. And ideally, you can direct them if they're able to. There are certain types of MRIs that are high resolution for the brainstem, where they will do 1 millimeter cuts through that region. And then there's a Fiesta protocol with the actual imaging where it can really highlight any sort of differences between the nerves and blood vessels. But oftentimes they will find in these more classic trigeminal neuralgia patients that one of the blood vessels that goes to the cerebellum, the superior cerebellar artery or the anterior inferior cerebellar artery, will often come in contact where the trigeminal ganglion is coming in to the brainstem. But I will tell you that I've had MRIs that have been taken even without contrast, where we turn around and say, no, we need to be 100% sure. We reorder the imaging, have it read again, or call the radiologist, and they'll often find that, hey, this nerve is in proximity to these blood vessels. And so that's possible etiology. And I tell patients, that's the type of trigeminal neuralgia that you want, actually. If that blood vessel is pushing on that nerve, that's the type of trigeminal neuralgia that typically responds better to treatment. But we have to understand that when they've done cadaver studies, they're actually more than you think. Many of us actually have close approximation of this blood vessel to these blood vessels to the trigeminal nerve. So it's not that this is only found in trigeminal neuralgia patients. It's also found in the general population, right? So we always have to understand that this could be the cause or this may not be. And so oftentimes, even when all the correct imaging is done, we still will find that, hey, not every case has this potential cause where a nerve is pushing on or a blood vessel is pushing on the nerve. Could just be an idiopathic form.
When you see that, I guess, compression or that contact there on the MRI and the radiologist notes it, what can you do for that patient? What kind of treatments are there?
Yeah, so that's when my job and your job are finished, in a sense, other than making that referral if we already haven't, because then this patient becomes a neurosurgical consult and a case. What they do is the neurosurgeon will then go in, look at the MRI themselves and evaluate, confirm everything. And then they will schedule the patient for a type of brain surgery. They make a craniotomy just posterior to the ear. They go in there and they're able to actually separate the blood vessel from the nerve. Sometimes they'll use a piece of Teflon in there. The newer treatments, which I think are even better, is they actually use this type of glue, we'll call it, and they actually just glue the two regions apart. There's been some cases, and sometimes it can happen, where by just putting that Teflon in between the two regions, in between the nerve and the blood vessel, it can then result in scar tissue. And certain patients have even developed granulomas, and then they have to go in and take the Teflon out and things like that. The response rate in general, though, for a patient, even if they have the Teflon or whether it's glued, typically very good. My impression is over 80% of patients can have long, long-lasting relief from this surgery when it's indicated. Obviously, there's a recovery. It is a brain surgery and things like that. I think if you're going to have brain surgery, this is probably the one that you want if it's indicated, because they're not cutting the tumor out. They're just separating two different structures, and then you're going to generally heal up well. Just the challenge is when you have older patients who, you know, they're at risk of having anesthesia. It is a brain surgery and things. For older patients, especially with significant health issues, you know, it can be a more dangerous procedure and the anesthesia and things like that.
Hey guys, real quick, KLS Martin is offering a 35% discount on my favorite KLS Martin instruments for everyday oral surgery listeners. So there's a link in the podcast notes with a full listing and a video highlighting some of the advantages of using KLS Martin instrumentation. To utilize this offer, use promo code STUCKYFAVES with a capital S and a capital F. So capital S, lowercase T-U-C-K-I, capital F, lowercase A-V-S. And you can use that through your KLS Martin sales rep or by emailing usa@klsmartin.com. I handpicked these instruments based on the kind of favorite extraction instruments that I use on a daily basis. And I hope you enjoy them. And how about for those that are, you know, idiopathic, where there's no imaging that really shows or we're not sure what's going on? What do you do for those guys?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So now we're still focusing on these patients who have the sharpshooting, stabbing pain. It wasn't caused by any sort of a procedure or anything like that. First off, when they come in, whether or not, even before we have the imaging, and this is very useful for the surgeons or dentists or whoever's comfortable doing it, you can start them on an anti-seizure medication, Tegretol and Trileptal. So Tegretol is carbamazepine, Trileptal is oxcarbazepine. These are sodium channel blockers. These sodium channel blockers are first line use for trigeminal neuralgia. So it is certainly within our capacity from a medical legal standpoint. If you are trained and are comfortable prescribing these, it is indicated. These drugs generally are very effective. They also, if they work, it also confirms your diagnosis of trigeminal neuralgia. If they do not work, we should question whether this is really trigeminal neuralgia. This doesn't mean that a patient may or may not tolerate the side effects or the medication, but oftentimes in these weird cases where, you know, they're not so cut and dry, Tegretol or Trileptal can be a nice confirmation of it. And so with this sodium channel blocker, the main things, if you want to give this medication, just some simple blood work, or if they've had recent blood work where they've had a CBC, platelet, diff, and metabolic panel. If you check those, you mainly are going to look at their platelet levels, make sure their platelets aren't low, make sure their neutrophil count's fine, make sure their sodium, most importantly, that sodium is good. The most common side effect is these medications, particularly in the elderly, anyone over 55 or even younger, it can cause hyponatremia. And so if you have that baseline blood work or can take a look at it, or you just call you can call their primary care physician and tell them and have primary care take over. I do not like to prescribe that medicine without baseline blood work, especially to check, you know, is the liver fine? Because these medications can, you know, elevate liver enzymes. They can drop the sodium levels. They can result in lowering thrombocytopenia. They can drop the neutrophil count. So these are all things you want to have good baseline blood work. And then I like to do blood work 2 to 4 weeks after starting the medicine, and then every month until we reach a stable dose. And oftentimes it takes 3-4 months, at least where I'm at, it takes 4 months to get into neurology, probably about that for neurosurgery. And so I'm always very grateful when I have one of these patients because, hey, we can get it managed, diagnosed, and make their life more comfortable. Second line medication, which still works not quite as well and generally is less well tolerated, is, I call it vitamin N, Neurontin. So many patients are on Neurontin, gabapentin. Also, its sister drug, which is absorbed a little bit better, called Lyrica or pregabalin. Gabapentin, it's a good drug. The nice thing is it doesn't interact as far as, there's no liver metabolization. It's no real strong interactions. You're not going to drop somebody's platelet levels. You're not going to change their blood count, anything like that. It's generally very safe. However, patients over 55 or even younger, gabapentin can make them dizzy, feel spacey, and feel out of it. Many providers, even you know, sometimes some endodontists will send cases over to me and they'll start a patient on a low dose of gabapentin. And I say, hey, that's great. As long as their GFR is generally fine, they say, hey, I don't have any kidney problems. Good. It's only patients where GFR would be under 30. I would be hesitant. They're not going to clear that drug very well, but it does increase the risk of falling. So gabapentin, you can whip out the 100s and say, hey, you can take 100 3 times a day. That's a really low dose, but that could be a lot for a little petite older lady. I usually will have to start at, if it's not somebody that's real small, usually start at 300 and you have them titrate up 300 at night. And then every few days you have them build up to TID and go from there. So that's a good option. Certainly you can try and do a nerve block in that region to turn it off. But Tegretol, Trileptal, I tend to favor Trileptal. That's just for kind of within my experience. I think it has a little bit less side effects. Or gabapentin or Lyrica. Those are great medicines that we can do. And that's what it really comes down to with these cases where there's not neurovascular conflict between the blood vessel and the nerve. Medication management is very important. There are other procedures that can be done that I can highlight that are not a brain surgery. So what these other procedures are, first one that I think is a really good option is just a simple rhizotomy. So you can send them off to neurosurgery. And again, every neurosurgeon does certain procedures, just like us dentists, we do certain procedures and some we don't. So for a rhizotomy, what they'll do is while you're sedated, they just go up here through the cheek, they guide this needle through and go up right into the ganglion area. And then what they can do is either do a balloon rhizotomy where they actually have this little balloon that they blow up and it puts pressure on the nerve, in a sense, damaging it. So they can do that with a balloon. They can also do it with glycerol, which is an alcohol solution, glycerol rhizotomy. And what that's trying to do is damage the nerve in a sense. And oftentimes those are fairly effective. The procedure is, you know, 30 minutes to an hour. It's not very long. It's generally quite safe. You don't have to go into deep anesthesia, general anesthesia, and they often work for several years for patients. There can be some side effects of, you know, numbness and dysesthesia, things like that, but that's a great option for a lot of patients where there's no indication for that microvascular decompression. That's the name of that brain surgery. So different types of rhizotomies, and that's all dependent on what the neurosurgeon is most comfortable with. I see it go both ways, glycerol or balloon. I think it's just a provider preference. Beyond that, there are some other procedures that are, you know, a little bit more invasive. Now, mind you, these procedures can be done for any trigeminal neuralgia patient as far as whether they have the blood vessel touching or not. You can do these rhizotomies. You can also do a procedure where you actually do some radio waves, so radio frequency ablation. Again, same thing, you're sedated, they can go in, do some radio frequency ablation on the nerve. And then also similar procedure is gamma knife. So they actually put your head in this device through their 3D mechanisms. They can direct radiation right at the trigeminal nerve, again, damaging it. That one in particular, gamma knife, or there's different names for it, but they have gamma radiation on the nerve. That one can result in more damage in a sense. And so most of the time, that's not the first procedure that these patients are having. But again, for the patients who do respond, it's very helpful. The cases that we usually see are the ones that don't go well, but that's not the norm. But unfortunately, when something doesn't work out, damaging the nerve can result in another type of neuropathic pain on top of the trigeminal neuralgia. It's a trigeminal neuralgia now with a neuropathy mixed in with it. So
another question I had do most of these patients just gradually develop this over time, or are there inciting events specifically? Has this ever been kind of triggered by actual dental procedures or things going on in the chair?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm so glad we got there. So in a sense, I consider the types of trigeminal neuralgia that we were just talking about, where there's neurovascular conflict or there's no neurovascular conflict, I consider those having nothing to do with us as dentists, meaning we had nothing to do to cause it. Okay. These are procedures. This is the type of trigeminal neuralgia where it is not related to anything any healthcare provider has done for them. Now, when we move over to other types of trigeminal neuralgias or neuropathies, remember we mentioned, hey, we've got a post-herpetic trigeminal neuralgia. We also have a type that's called a post-traumatic trigeminal neuropathy, or just simply it's a post-procedure trigeminal nerve disorder, right? somebody does an implant, you know, they're around tooth number, you know, 20, let's just say 23. They go in there, they can drop that implant in, and maybe it happens to hit the mental nerve, right? That can cause a trigeminal neuropathy. That's a unfortunate oops, right? But less invasive things than, let's say, a surgical procedure or something like that, even simply a root canal, a dental filling, maybe even just having clamp on the tooth. You know, in any consent that we look at, even for injections, it always lists that there could be potential nerve damage. So even an IA nerve block, you know, is very, very rare, but you could cause a neuropathy, right? You could cause a trigeminal nerve condition as a result simply of the needle going adjacent to, unlikely to transect the nerve, but adjacent to the region of the nerve. So any dental procedure could cause a type of trigeminal neuropathy. Usually when I'm coming in, that's how I differentiate as far as terminology. You know, in general, we could call it trigeminal neuralgia, but I usually say, hey, this is more a type of post-procedure neuropathy. Those can be very challenging because, you know, was there trigeminal neuralgia before, like a classic sharp shooting stabbing pain that was mainly felt in number 30? And then, you know, whoever went in and said, yeah, I see something there. I'm going to do the root canal. And then the root canal doesn't work. And then they say, oh, you know what? There's probably a crack in it. Let's get that tooth out of there. They extract that tooth. And guess what? There's still pain there. So those are tough cases. Is this a chicken or egg type of scenario when there's been multiple procedures done? And it's challenging because some of these cases, like I get patients that said 3-4 years ago, I had this dental procedure. I had this done. And so I always have to say, was your pain different, you know, after the initial healing period of the procedure, after the first root canal? They say no, then to me, that makes sense that it's not really from the root canal or whatever it was. But certainly we as dentists can and do cause neuropathic pain, even from the most perfectly well done procedure. Okay. My colleague and I, I work in the main office that I'm in. We've got two amazing oral surgeons. Every once in a while, one of these third molars, it's usually a lower one, comes out and, you know, they might have a little bit of the typical, hey, it feels a little numb. I feel a little bit of tingling in my lip. You know, that's a type of neuropathy, right? I feel like you as oral surgeons on every extraction case that's always in there, hey, you could get this, especially on lower thirds. Well, in some of these cases, even without, and I'm not talking lingual nerve damage, just IA, even in the most easy, well-done extraction, we've seen cases where this trigeminal nerve becomes sensitized and reacts and doesn't go away within a year. And these patients now are on Tegretol, gabapentin, we take an MRI, all of these things like that. And we show that there was no damage to the nerve, but just simply disconnecting this tooth, which has a nerve going into it, just simply disconnecting that tooth from the nerve was enough for that particular patient to develop, you know, a neuropathy. Those are rare that they don't resolve, but that can happen. So when I get referrals, I tell the patient, I say, listen, if there was something grossly wrong with the procedure, I think we would have admitted the dentist, whoever the provider would have said, hey, you know what? It didn't go as planned, blah, blah, blah. We would own up to it. But I always try and tell patients, usually this is not just because your dentist did something wrong. This is just you happen to have one of the unlucky ones. I do tell providers that I do believe there are particular patients who are at risk for complications. Anybody who has a history of, you know, other nerve conditions, even migraine headaches that are chronic, fibromyalgia, or even autoimmune conditions, my experience has been that these patients are more prone to odd types of healing and just kind of more difficulty with developing neuropathies. And whether it's a genetic, it's likely a genetic thing, how their physiology is working, the inflammatory, you know, processes in their body and how that can lead to nerve sensitization. I think there's a whole variety of factors there. But when we have patients who already are in chronic pain, their nervous systems are primed to react. There's no pain until the signals truly reach the brain. Everything out in the periphery is really just, we've got these mechanoreceptors, proprioception. These are all just electrical signals. And then our brain, once they hit there, we interpret it as, hey, this is pain. So the brain, our brainstem, and even higher centers within our brain, it can amplify, turn up, or decrease that pain. And so many of these chronic pain patients have this nervous system that is very attuned to be very reactive. But on the other hand, there are patients who are perfectly healthy who will have something like this after the extraction of a maxillary tooth routine, and they develop a small neuropathy in the region. And there was no sinus perforation. There was no, everything was done perfectly well. There are cases like that that can happen. That's why I really like to differentiate. You know, there are different types of trigeminal nerve disorders, ones that occur just because of we were doing something to the area, and others that can happen for other reasons.
That makes sense. Is there, because I've had third molar patients and other types of patients that, you know, a month or two or three afterward, they'll come back for follow-up and yeah, I'm still having pain. You know, the x-ray checks out, there's no infection. The site looks perfect, like it healed fine. And it's just kind of confusing and we're not really sure what to do other than, well, let's just wait and see, you know, what can happen or things like that. I mean, at what point should we say, yeah, let's get you over to oral facial pain, you know, and does timing matter? I guess that's a kind of a double question, but, you know, how do you answer that type of stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question. My general opinion is, and I'm learning the oral surgery side of things, you know, I went right out of dental school, right into oral facial pain. I was joking around. I said, if you asked me to do a surgical extraction or an extraction, I'd be sweating bullets. You know, I'd rather deal with these complicated facial pain patients who have been to 10 doctors. And, you know, so I've learned a lot on the oral surgery side, and I'm very grateful for working with my colleagues. And, you know, it's been a very good relationship from both sides. My general advice is, and right now, I do medical legal consulting. One of the things that's really sneaky is we have to always be careful when there's an abnormal healing or lack of healing. Be on the watch for osteomyelitis. We had a young patient, healthy male, who developed osteomyelitis not that long after the extraction. It was very odd. That's very rare. You'd think this is more so be somebody who was older, but certainly that follow-up x-ray, if you're going to go in and debride an area, I think it's good to have that follow-up. Cone beam CT, even potentially in a sense, consider sending off bacterial culture and, you know, the path report. I know that's very rare and oral surgeons catch all of those things. There is an unfortunate case that I have been reviewing where they were a little bit slow to get to that point and they got there. But by that time, the osteomyelitis had progressed. You know, PICC line after that, and IV antibiotics. And now the whole trigeminal nerve was just really, really bad. It was just so inflamed, even after things were under control. So it became a big lawsuit. And so certainly from the oral surgery side of things, I think taking that follow-up x-ray, doing all those things that you all are amazing at. And certainly if there's ever a question, you know, it's okay to do a culture and send off to PATH just to make sure. My general thought is if something seems out of the norm, if you have 100 patients and they're outside of the typical 95 patients, that 4 or 5, you know, percent, I would say I'd watch them very closely, make sure they have a post-op, you know, and then after a normal period of time, if they're still having significant symptoms after a month, maybe we consider, as you're watching them and monitoring them, maybe we consider starting a low dose of gabapentin, or even there are other medications like Cymbalta, which is duloxetine, or amitriptyline, or nortriptyline, which are tricyclic antidepressants. Not using those for depression, those are used for other types of neuropathies that aren't the classic trigeminal neuralgia. So when we have something that's aching, burning, pins and needles, that's not predominated by a sharp shooting, stabbing electrical sensation, usually we're using gabapentin, Lyrica, Cymbalta, Elavil, which is amitriptyline, or Pamelor. So there are other low dose of medications that we can use to help patients. in those situations, I think every case with the surgeon, you know, I usually end up having to get on with the surgeon and say, hey, do you feel like this is just really abnormal as far as the healing? When they say that, and I say, let's get them on the medicine and we'll just keep watching them. So my opinion is it's better to start any sort of neuropathic pain agent, even if it's just before bed, just for a month or two as things are healing up. I think it's better to do it earlier, because if somebody's drug out 3-4 months, you know, their lips burning, it's in pain, things like that, I think starting medications sooner, and we can always wean them off as things get better.
I like that. Yeah, that's some good advice and good things for us to hear. And nice that your practice has you and others in the area. Sometimes it's a struggle, I will say, to find a good oral facial pain specialist. I feel like we need to produce more of those as a country or something. It can be challenging, and some of these patients, you know, go from doctor to doctor and no one's really sure what to do. So this is a great resource for those patients who are struggling with some of these neurology, because they're going to be pretty life-altering, as I've heard some of my patients talk about. Teratogenic or things that caused or are occurring in the dental chair, you're saying sooner the better. Let's say you see them at the 2-week mark or 1 month mark and still having some pain, but it's looking like it's healed. Maybe it's just a flared up, you know, cranial nerve. Then let's get them on maybe some medication and try to get them in to see an oral facial pain specialist. Does that sound about right?
Anytime after what we feel like the typical healing period should be, at least initially. So certainly if you feel like, hey, this is just abnormal for 1 month, this is just, or an exaggerated case, you know, we all have patients who have just slower or delayed healing for whatever reason. Certainly, you know, oral facial pain, there are great oral medicine doctors. You can talk to primary care. It's an easy phone call. And you just say, hey, I think they've got, or just fax over, hey, they've got a little neuropathy after a procedure. Can you manage the case with, you know, gabapentin, whatever? Neuro, certainly, if you can get them in. I will say, you know, neurologists are amazing at what they do, but they're all about the nervous system. Let's say you do this procedure, and this happened. We had this young person who came down for school. She had her third molars extracted in the Midwest, came down to University of South Carolina right after. So all of this horrible, horrendous pain after the third molar extraction, perfectly healthy young female, horrible pain. And they actually called our office and they saw my colleague, Dr. Fahm. He saw this young lady. He said, there's nothing wrong. There's no dry socket. There's just, but she happened to have a lot of temporomandibular symptoms, right? So he sent her over to me because, you know, he likes to do the surgical. I'd like to do the non-surgical. I took a look. Her temporalis tendons were on fire. And so oftentimes what's easily forgotten is that some of these post-procedure patients, especially a long root canal, you know, doing a bridge, you know, advanced, you know, oral surgery, you know, something, or it's just taking a little bit longer. That's a long time for a lot of these patients to be wide open. That can cause severe temporalis tendonitis. The masseters and temporalis can flare up. So, and then they can come back and they're limited. It's like they have trismus, it's sore, it can be radiating. You know, you're going to check the area. It's going to seem fine. The gums, you're going to feel the gums. It's like, you know, everything seems fine. And then you feel the temporalis tendon, like, oh, that hurts. The masseter hurts, things like that. So I think every oral surgeon and dentist should have in their arsenal, or at least consider it. You can do a steroid injection right into the temporalis tendon, put some Canalog up there. You can do a trigger point injection, just take some local anesthetic, you know, right into that region, good muscle relaxer, Medrol dose pack, followed by an NSAID. So some of these post-procedure patients, you know, I'm talking within a week or so, they're going to just say, hey, I'm just so bad right now. And so certainly screening for temporomandibular disorders, even if it's an acute thing, is very important. So temporalis tendon injection, a simple trigger point injection, more moissanite on the masseter, those can go a long way. We ended up having to treat this individual, not for any sort of dental alveolar complication, but her TMD flared up. She reported none prior, but it flared up or started up in a sense after this procedure. you know, we did trigger points, tendon injections. We got her mouth guard. We had her on anti-inflammatory, on Flexeril, all those things. And, you know, within about 3 weeks or so, she was doing way better. But her and her mom were so concerned about nerve damage and all of this. And, you know, it was like one of those cases where they came in and they were really hot and really frustrated in a sense. And so, you know, we as dentists, we need to own the temporomandibular complex and the dental alveolar complex. And so even evaluating, you know, that temporalis tendon can be a sneaky little bugger and be very painful after these long procedures. So that's my two cents. The last thing I'd really like to say, you know, let's say it's been several months after a procedure and somebody just still is saying there's pain. You know, as oral surgeons and dentists, you know, when we're checking outside on the skin, we do our 4-point directions, you know, we check, hey, is there sensation, all that stuff. If you go into the region where the procedure was done, the extraction or root canal, take a little cotton tip, touch that cotton tip on an outside of the region, and then rub it right where the procedure was done. Some of these patients, you can show that their nerve is sensitized because if they have allodynia. So allodynia is pain to a stimulus that should not be painful. So when I get these patients after a procedure, I am looking for any peripheral nerve sensitization in the gums, in the gingiva. And sometimes we'll find it and I'll touch a region. They'll say, that's my pain. It's all healed up. It's right over the extraction site. The gingiva has just become sensitized. Things like that. So that's another easy way for you to see and kind of localize something. Now, just because they don't have that does not mean that, you know, the nerve isn't sensitized deeper down in the bone or closer to the root. But certainly that's an easy way to see, is there pain in the area, even the soft touch where I just touch or I rub the area very gently. Another easy way to really diagnose if there's a peripherally induced neuropathy of some of the intraoral tissues.
I like that. That's a good tip. Probably sometimes we may skip or forget about because you just kind of look and, oh, it looks normal, but we don't, you know, palpate it or kind of do some of these diagnostic tests to see if there's allodynia. But yeah, super helpful. Good things for us to be aware of. And I think to have a good colleague to refer to and, like you're saying, being aware of the, you know, the TMJ complex getting stimulated and inflamed, and certainly a lot of the forces that we're, you know, placing on a patient's jaw during extraction, you know, the potential to cause some of this stuff. So I think this has been helpful and appreciate you running through some of this stuff with us. We end every podcast with some rapid fire questions. So my first question for you is, what is the best book you've read lately?
Oh man, I've got three little girls real young. So I honestly have not read a book in very long. Everything I'm reading little snippets. So no books yet.
No worries. I get that phase of life. How about what non-oral facial pain thing do you do in your life that helps you with your daily oral facial pain skills?
Yeah, I think just being outside, exercise, and just trying to be out in nature. These patients can be emotionally taxing and I have a practice full of them. And so I think trying to take care of my emotional health to give and not just feel like I'm giving from an empty tank, because there is a large psychological component. So I think us connecting with our inner selves or nature, you know, is very important.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think there's, you know, a lot of that, of course, in oral surgery too. We deal with very anxious, stressed out patients every hour on the hour. Sometimes even the calm patients, we get worked up with how difficult their teeth are to extract. And I'm sure similar thing with you, you probably have a lot of complicated patients. It's not just a quick fix and probably multiple follow-ups and problem solving and stuff like that. So good to take care of your mental health. Another question, do you watch movies or any TV series?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, oh, yeah. What's your favorite recent movie you've seen?
I started up the Halo series. I was a little doubtful, but next episode comes out tomorrow, so I'm all over it. Halo.
Nice. What platform is that on?
Paramount.
Paramount, okay. Check that out. Last question, what is your favorite quote?
That's a great question. I think in my mind, there's a simple quote, you know, by small things are great things brought to pass. And I think for us as individuals and for patients, you know, it's all these little small things that really add up to be the great things. And so I'm learning every day, every patient, all of these working with the oral surgeons, I'm learning every day. And I think that's just great to realize none of us have plateaued and there's always something to learn from every other provider, no matter who they are.
Love that quote. Kind of reminds me of there's a quote similar to that, like a large door swings on small hinges or something like that. No, I think the longer I'm in practice, the more I realize how small, subtle things I do make a big impact in the patient experience and, you know, their outcomes. And so I feel like, the most of us, the longer you're getting out, the more you appreciate what the small things can really do for your patients. So good quote. Well, TJ, thank you so much for your time today. It's been invaluable. I've enjoyed it and learned a lot. If there are listeners who have further questions for you, are you okay if they reach out to you?
Yeah, sure. Sure. You can email me. Certainly, you can share that. It's T as in Tom, Robbins, letter T, and then Robbins at mycenters.com. That's my work email. Feel free to reach out anytime.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. Let's keep in touch and maybe we'll do another episode on oral facial pain down the road.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. Have a good rest of the day.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I love feedback and would be very grateful if you would reach out to me via my email, grantstuckey@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought of this episode. Or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Additionally, if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, or if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, please email or text me. I found many of my interviewees through people who have been contacting me and have been listening, and I've gotten so many great ideas for more podcasts, and that's what helps keep the podcast rolling. So really appreciate you making that extra effort and helping me out with feedback and knowing what to do next on the podcast. Thank you so much. Thank you.